We'll be reading this morning from Matthew chapter 17, verse 24 through 27. When they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax went up to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the tax?" He said, "Yes." And when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?" And when he said, "From others," Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself." This is the word of the Lord. Would you open your Bibles, please, to Matthew chapter 17, verse 24. We'll start there this morning. In ancient times, as in our time, it was the ruler of a people who ordered a count, who took a census of those who were his own. But in the Old Testament book of Exodus, chapter 30, verses 11 through 16, it is God himself who we find there giving instructions about how to carry out such a count. And who does God count? Who does the ruler of heaven and earth number as the people belonging to him? What we find there in Exodus chapter 30 is that those God calls and numbers as his own are those he has just rescued out of slavery. In the days of Moses, soon after giving him the plans for building the tabernacle, God tells him how to take a census, a numbering of the people who've been brought out of Egypt into the wilderness. And it's an exercise that's meant to bring home to the people that to be counted as belonging to God, they must also be counted as those who could not save themselves, but had to be rescued and saved by him. And so there in that text, as they're being counted and as they're being identified in this way, each man, 20 years old and older, was required to offer up a small payment to God as a symbolic ransom. It was to be an acknowledgement of their helplessness and sin, an acknowledgement of their unworthiness to be numbered in God's family, an acknowledgement that each and every one who was counted as belonging to Yahweh owed him their very lives. And God tells Moses that each one of these individuals must pay the same amount for this symbolic ransom price for their life. The rich were not to pay more than a half shekel of silver, as though their lives were worth more than the lives of the poor. And the poor were not to pay less than a half shekel of silver, as though their lives were somehow worth less to God than the lives of the rich. No, this gracious, symbolic half-shekel payment, which was also called atonement money by God, was to be the same payment given in place of or on behalf of one and all. So that, as one commentator put it, in the matter of atonement, all stood on the same platform. And so we read there in Exodus, "Everyone who is numbered in the census from 20 years old and upward shall give the Lord's offering. The rich shall not give more, the poor shall not give less than the half shekel when you give the Lord's offering to make atonement for your lives." You know, some of those who were counted in that census were simple and some were wise. Some who were counted in that census were well known and others were completely unknown. Some of those who were counted in that census were young. Some of them were old. Some of those who were counted in that census were great God offenders, and some of them lesser offenders. But in the words of Charles Henry McIntosh, the ground of atonement is alike for all. The ground of atonement is alike for all. And what was this collected atonement money supposed to be used for? Well, it initially seems to have been intended as kind of a one-time payment by the people of that generation for the construction and the upkeep of the tabernacle. And in fact, we find out in Exodus 38 that most of the silver from all of those half-shekel coins got used to make the silver bases that held up the tabernacle panel walls. So that you could say the tabernacle was literally founded on the silver of atonement. But why use the census money for that? Why use the silver of all those half shekels to build and then to maintain this tiny place where Eden was recreated only here inside this tent? This one place where God could once again dwell with his people in holiness and meet with them in peace. We're told in verse 16 of Exodus 30 that they were to use this atonement money in this way so that it may bring the people of Israel to remembrance before the Lord, so as to make atonement for your lives. What this means is that every time both God and the people of Israel looked at that tabernacle, it was to be a reminder of the privileges enjoyed through that place. Forgiveness, blessing, holiness, peace, inclusion, that they had come only, all of those privileges, it was to be a reminder that all of those privileges had come only on the basis of a paid ransom. Only on the basis of an atonement price. As one commentator put it, the tabernacle was to be a constant reminder to both God and the people of Israel that only on the basis of atonement can communion exist between heaven and earth. Well, time passed, and in time, this one-off tax seems to have morphed out of necessity into a more regular tax that was levied on males 20 years and older every time a census was taken. So that it actually began to be referred to as a census tax. And the change made sense. I mean, as one can imagine, after a much larger temple was built to replace the tabernacle, the needs for upkeep and maintenance were also much greater, and so the tax became more frequent. Well, fast forward again many centuries, and we hear about the tax once again in the days after the Jews have returned home from captivity in Babylon. There in the Old Testament book of Nehemiah chapter 10, we read these words among a list of resolutions of the people who have come back. We also take on ourselves the obligation to give yearly a third part of a shekel for the service of the house of our God. So after 70 years in exile, away from the tabernacle, away from the temple, the people of God have returned to Jerusalem in small bands to rebuild their city and to reestablish their way of life. So they first rebuild the temple under Ezra's leadership, and then the walls of the city under the leadership of Nehemiah. And now they're putting back into operation, they're putting back into place such things as the census tax to help maintain the newly rebuilt temple. Only now, instead of taxing men only when there's a census, we're told the tax will now be taken yearly, and that a third part of the shekel will be given for the service of the house of our God. So here it's interesting, instead of a half shekel, the tax has been lowered to a third part of a shekel, probably just because the general poverty of the whole nation, having just come back from exile. It's also interesting that instead of a census tax, this is now more accurately coming to be known as a temple tax. So that most scholars agree, in the words of John Hanna, that this practice became the basis of the later temple tax that became an annual tax in the time of Christ. So that brings us up to our text today. So I want you to know what this tax is that we're talking about. In the time of Christ, the temple tax was again a half shekel contribution that was paid annually into the temple treasury by all adult males every year. This could also be paid in a contemporary monetary equivalent, such as if you didn't have shekels, you could pay in the Greek didrachm or double drachma, or as some of your Bibles say, the two drachmas. But the point is, whether paid with a half shekel, or whether paid with two drachmas, or whether paid with two denarii, the amount of this tax came out to 2 days' wages, and it could be paid in person in Jerusalem or through temple representatives who were sent out to collect this tax in the countryside, which brings us to to our text today. Look with me now at verse 24. When they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax went up to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the tax?" We saw last time in verse 22 that the disciples were gathering in Galilee. Those disciples with Jesus on the mountain and those disciples who'd stayed behind in the valley were now back as one united group in the staging area of Galilee and were making their final preparations to journey south into Judean territory. And so it makes sense that this gathering and all these final preparations are being made back in Capernaum, which has been their ministry base of operations in the north for the past few years. But Capernaum, we've said, is a small town. And if you remember, we believe Peter and Andrew's house was almost right across the street from the town synagogue. You may remember me mentioning in another sermon that if you go to visit the ruins of ancient Capernaum today, one of the few identifiable structures you can still see are the ruins of that synagogue. The floor, at least, of that synagogue is the same floor of the original synagogue. And not only that, one of the only other identifiable structures in the ruins of modern-day Capernaum is what most archaeologists believe is the actual remains of St. Peter's house. It's really, really amazing. You can stand there and see with your own eyes how far the walk was from one building to the other. And we said that they're only about 30 yards apart. Well, what that tells me is that it probably didn't take long for the tax-collecting representatives from Jerusalem to catch wind of the return of Peter to his home along with his famous rabbi house guest. And so they do what tax collectors do, even though these aren't tax collectors from Rome. They do what tax collectors do. They spring into action and they come to collect. But they come first to Peter and not to Jesus. Why is that? When they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax went up to Peter, the text says. Well, it might just be because Peter is the one hosting Jesus. And so maybe they go to him first as a matter of common courtesy. It is his house. It's Peter's house. It makes sense to go to the one who owns the house. Or maybe they're a bit in awe of Jesus, and it feels awkward to go to ask him directly to pay this tax. These aren't necessarily people hostile to Jesus' ministry like the Pharisees. But my hunch is, at the very least, they've come because they're concerned, knowing the really big influence that Jesus has over what others will do. What kind of effect will this teacher have on their collections in this region, given the influence he has over so many followers? And their concerns aren't unfounded. There are other groups in Jesus' day who refused to pay the tax. There were the members of the Qumran community who stubbornly refused to pay the temple tax more than once in a lifetime as a matter of principle. They just wouldn't do it. They weren't going to budge. And so, at the very least, I think these guys come to Peter dreading such a hassle. I think they're hoping that's not going to be the case with Jesus. I think they come with a sneaking suspicion, though, that Jesus might also pose this kind of a problem to their work. And so maybe now they come to Peter for the inside scoop because he's got a reputation for blurting things out that others might not. And so they ask him point blank, "WWJD, what will Jesus do?" Right? When they come to Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax went up to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the tax?" Except that the grammatical structure of their question tells us they're actually asking it in a way that expects or is really trying its best to get an affirmative answer back. It sounds like, it kind of sounds like they're asking this question the same way a very clever and hopeful 5-year-old might ask about getting a cookie, right? The really smart ones don't just say, "Can I have a cookie?" They say, "I can have a cookie, right?" And so this question would be better stated in English this way. The teacher does pay the tax, doesn't he? They're really wanting an affirmative answer. And what is the answer Peter hastily blurts out. Look at the first part of verse 25. He answers in the affirmative. He says, yes, yes, of course, Peter seems to say, as if it's almost as if he can't get the words out fast enough. Yes, of course, Jesus pays the tax. We don't want any trouble, guys. He's no traitor. He's a true Jew. He's loyal. The thing is, we're not told if Peter has ever even discussed this with Jesus or not. And the fact that we have a whole conversation about it in the rest of the verse suggests that he hadn't talked this over with Jesus yet. And so to me, the whole story almost feels like Peter is hoping to deal with this tax situation quietly, without ever letting Jesus hear anything about their inquiry. It almost feels to me like Peter is trying to be secretive here, like he's hurrying into the house to see if he can rustle up the money to pay these guys off before Jesus looks out the window and sees them there on the porch. But what happens next in verse 25? And when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?" As you could say, Simon's busted. See, there are some who think, and I tend to agree, that Simon is still doing everything in his power here to prevent the dark future that Jesus has now predicted twice. There's some who think, and I agree, that he's still working to try and keep that from happening, to keep that from coming to pass. Simon Peter may not understand why Jesus keeps talking about suffering and death at the hands of the religious authorities, and he may not speak out against these passion predictions anymore as he did once. But in his mind, I think it's possible he's still determined to quietly do everything in his power to prevent the Christ from meeting this end. And I think we could say his actions with a sharp sword later on in the Garden of Gethsemane seem to confirm this suspicion. Because remember, Peter has seen Jesus confronting and offending the religious leaders countless times before. Think back to the way his words about washing hands offended the Pharisees in chapter 15. I'll talk about that in just a minute. And so I think he's worried Jesus might do it again here and refuse to pay the tax outright and just keep making things worse for himself when he gets to Jerusalem. And so as Edersheim puts it, it's possible this incident is really just another less obvious way of Peter saying, "Far be it from you, Lord. Far be it from you." You know, the first time Peter said that to Jesus, it was out loud. It was a way of saying, "I know better than you what should happen here, Jesus." And he was strongly rebuked for this hard-headed thinking there, and rightly so. You know, and sometimes that's enough to get us to humbly obey God, to get us to humbly trust God. But other times our doubts linger, don't they? Sometimes even when we're confronted with our unbelief, even when we're confronted with something like that, our doubts get driven underground instead of completely disappearing. And so we put on a smiley face on Sunday mornings and we say the right things, but we're still thinking and acting in subtle ways that say, "I'm not sure Jesus knows what he's doing." And if that's really what Peter's doing here by trying to handle this tax issue on his own, Jesus once again calls him on it. But he does so gently this time. Jesus is inside Peter's house, and our text says when Peter comes back inside from his conversation with the temple tax collectors, Jesus spoke to him first. If you have a King James Version, the words in your Bible will sound very strange here. Your verse will say, "Jesus prevented him." But the word "prevented" is just a really old way of saying Jesus went before him. He prevented him. He went before him. And so the meaning is the same, that Jesus already knows what's going on with Peter. He anticipates all the questions and all the options swirling in Peter's mind and speaks before Peter can say or do anything. And what Jesus says reveals that he knows not just what's gone on outside with these tax collectors, but also everything going on inside Peter's heart. Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?" You know, we can't hide our thoughts from Jesus. I don't know if you've thought about that much. For Jesus, it's like when a family plays a game and the four-year-old is constantly laying his cards out on the kitchen table in plain sight, and you're trying to teach him, no, you got to keep those secret, but he just keeps laying them out there. We can't hide our cards from Jesus. We can't. We can't hide our thoughts. We can't hide our motives. We can't hide our fears. We can't hide our workarounds, our fail-safes, our lean-on-our-own-understanding backup plans. We can't hide any of those things from Jesus. All our cards are always on the table and laid bare before his sight. And sometimes, because he loves you, Jesus will speak to you first about those things like he speaks to Peter here. Sometimes he will let you know in some startling way that he knows about those doubts and fears and schemes and secretive thoughts in order to put your eyes back on him and remind you who he is. And how does he do that here? I mean, other than making it clear that he knows about the temple tax issue, how does Jesus remind Peter who he is? Well, he starts by giving an analogy. What do you think, Peter? He says, "From whom do the kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?" At this point, Jesus isn't suddenly, you know, this isn't now suddenly becoming a story about the paying of civil taxes. He's just making an analogy about the way taxation works in general. Okay? And so when it comes to earthly kings, Jesus asks, who do they take toll or tribute from? Right? A toll being the duty put on goods and services, a tribute being a tax put on individuals. And so he says, do earthly kings collect toll or tax from their own sons, from their own family, or from those outside the family, from others? It's like asking, if I as a father have a vegetable garden, from whom do I require payment for the enjoyment of those vegetables? From my own sons, from my own family, or from others at the farmer's market? And the obvious answer in both cases is from others. From others. In both cases, sons enjoy freedoms, others don't. Which is exactly how we're told Peter answers the question. From others, he says. Look now at verse 26. And when he said, from others, Jesus said to him, then the sons are free. What Jesus means by free is that the royal sons are exempt from paying the tax. And so the big idea of our text today and the point of Jesus' analogy, the point that's the same, that sons enjoy freedoms that others don't, especially the sons of royalty. And the first freedom royal sons enjoy is the freedom from obligation to pay what others have to pay. Well, how are we to understand Jesus' analogy as it relates to the temple tax situation? Well, it's very simple. It's very simple. In the case of the temple tax, who ultimately is the ruler or king of the temple who has issued this tax in the first place? It's, according to Exodus 30, it's God. It's God. Peter knows that that title belongs to God alone and that the Jewish people are his subjects, the others from Jesus' analogy, which leaves only the sons. Who are the sons that are free? The ones exempt from the obligation to pay the temple tax? Only the son of the king of the temple. Only the Son of God. And Jesus is that royal son, as Peter himself has already confessed, and as Peter himself has already heard confirmed from the cloud on the mountain. Since the temple is his Father's house, Jesus is explaining to Peter that he, as the Son of the living God, is exempt from payment. Jesus is free from the obligation to pay the temple tax that others have to pay. There is no divine command that applies to him on this matter. And so how does Jesus put Peter's eyes back on him and remind Peter of who he is as Peter's doubts and fears begin to rise in his heart surrounding this temple tax situation. This simple tax analogy is how. Through it, he reminds Peter that he is not just my buddy Jesus. Through it, he reminds Peter that he's not just my best friend Jesus. Through it, he reminds Peter that he's not just my poor, misguided rabbi Jesus. Through it, he reminds Peter that he's not just a carpenter from Nazareth who is a guest in my house, Jesus. No, Simon. The one you're trying to keep secrets from is Jesus, the Son of the living God. No, Simon. The one you're trying to protect is Jesus, God's beloved Son, in whom he is well pleased. No, Simon. The one you doubt knows best is Jesus, the almighty Son of the King. What do you think, Simon? It's almost a playful rebuke, isn't it? It's so gentle. And I think Jesus doesn't call him Peter here, you might notice, because he knows he's not dealing with the hard stubbornness of a rock this time, but the stressed out frailty of a reed, and a bruised reed he will not break. His rod is not a rod of iron to break us, writes Thomas Watson, but a fatherly rod to humble us. Aren't you glad for the perfect corrections of Jesus? And aren't you glad for his powerful reminders of who he is when you start to doubt that he knows best? I've got this, Simon, Jesus seems to say, and I've got you. This is the Jesus you serve too. Same Jesus. Lay your fears down at his feet. Cast your cares on him because he cares for you. He's got this, and he's got you. But here we've sort of interrupted Jesus mid-sentence because his own exemption from this temple tax isn't the only freedom he enjoys as the Son of the King. He doesn't have to pay out of obligation, but the second freedom he has as the Son of the King is the freedom to pay the tax anyway out of love. The second freedom royal sons enjoy is the freedom to love by paying what they don't have to pay anyway. Look now at verse 27. However, Jesus says to Peter, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up, and when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself. Now, there's a lot going on there, but there's two main things going on there, and it's this. We have the freedom of Jesus to do something he doesn't have to do, and then we have the miraculous way he does it. Well, let's just start first with the thing Jesus doesn't have to do, but tells Peter he's going to do anyway, pay the temple tax. The short of it is Jesus tells Peter he'll pay it, and this can only be a purely loving act for Jesus because Jesus is the only one who doesn't really have to do it. What I mean is that technically speaking, Peter and every other Jewish male over 20 is still obligated to do this under the law. And so for them, it isn't really love. It's more like duty. You know, I don't keep the speed limit because I love highway patrol officers. Sorry, Tom. I keep it because it's the law, and I keep it because I'm obligated to keep it under threat of penalty. And to flip that around in a similar way, the government can't enforce the law and then try to sell it as some grand act of love towards me, a citizen. No, by legislating and enforcing legitimate laws that protect its citizens, the state is likewise just doing its duty. Protecting its citizens is the obligation of the state. But as we've already seen, Jesus isn't obligated to pay this tax. And yet he says he'll do so anyway, not out of fear or for his own benefit, but with the best interest of others in mind. And that's real love. And I see it as a way of showing love in three directions. I think this isn't in your notes, but I think Jesus is showing his love, first of all, for his Father's house. I think Jesus is showing his love, second of all, for the collectors of the temple tax. And I think Jesus is showing his love for Peter here. First, I think giving this tax when he doesn't have to is simply an expression of Christ's love for his Father's house. Jesus will give a half shekel of silver into the temple treasury, even though he knows that much of what he gives goes into the hands of evil men, will be used under the influence of evil men. Jesus will give a half shekel of silver into the temple treasury, even though he knows, in the words of R.C. Sproul, that the whole function of the temple soon will be irrelevant and obsolete, because in just a few days, he will offer the perfect sacrifice once for all there. Jesus will give a half shekel of silver into the temple treasury, even though he knows that within the lifetime of that generation, the temple will be leveled by the Romans, so that not a single stone will remain one upon another there. So why does Jesus give it? Because the temple is not the idea or the work of sinful men. It is a gift from God. It is the graciously given picture and promise of his Father's work for the world. And until the day his own body steps into the spotlight on a cross and is lifted up as the true temple, the one the tabernacle and the temple of stone pointed to all along, until then, the one fulfilling all their purposes on a single Friday afternoon, until that day, Jesus knows, this picture of promise is still worth supporting. It's still worth giving to. Second, I think Jesus is showing his love for the collectors of the temple tax. You know, the most explicit reason given in our text for why he's paying this tax, he says to Peter, is not to give offense to them. And I believe the them here refers to those taxmen. And so this too is an act of love, because as we're told in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, love does not insist on its own way in matters of true personal freedom. In areas of life where no divine command applies. And as we've seen, for Jesus, in a very unique way as the Son of God, this is one of those areas. He is free to not pay the tax, and he is free to pay the tax. But since he seems to believe not paying will cause unnecessary offense, he chooses to pay it. The word for offense here is a word that literally means to cause to stumble. I think it's a pretty good and vivid word for what can happen when things are going along smoothly in a conversation, or things are going along smoothly in a relationship or in a way of thinking, and then suddenly someone says or does something that disrupts everything. It's like a tree root and a person doesn't see coming on a footpath. You know, you trip, your foot hits that root you didn't see. It's like a speed bump a person doesn't see coming on a fast road. It's a disruption that can jolt you in a different direction. And sometimes, as we've seen already in Jesus' own ministry, such disruptions are absolutely necessary sometimes for the sake of truth, for the sake of obedience to God's word, for the sake of duty to the king, even for the sake of love. For the sake of love, sometimes these disruptions, these offenses, are necessary. For instance, we've seen Jesus, as I mentioned already back in chapter 15, just completely unconcerned about giving offense when he disagreed with the Pharisees over the custom of hand washing, you know, and he wouldn't submit to it. So there he doesn't seem worried about causing offense at all. Why was that offense okay? Why was that offense back in chapter 15 even loving? It was okay and it was loving because something fundamental was at stake. What was at stake in that case was the elevation of man's laws to the same level as God's laws. That's what was at stake there. And Jesus wouldn't submit to that. He would rather cause an offense in that case than submit. And Jesus knew that only by jolting the Pharisees in that uncomfortable way would it be possible for them to go in a different direction, the right direction. And we'll have to give offense in many similar necessary ways today as well. there are some necessary ways we still have to give offense. We've been talking about this, you know, during several recent sermons and in some of your recent newsletters when it comes to things like affirming gay marriage or affirming the wrong personal pronouns, for example. We, too, will have to gently but firmly refuse to submit. Not because we hate someone, not because we want to bring harm to them, but because these modern customs represent defiant challenges both to God's law and to God's gospel. And to submit to them is to allow people to keep driving smoothly down a highway towards destruction. Which means that in those cases, giving offense is absolutely necessary. In those cases, giving offense is the greatest act of love, because it is only love that will throw itself on a highway to hell in order to be a speed bump that might, by the grace of God, jolt someone into going a different direction. Does that make sense? But the point of Jesus' choice here to pay the tax is that not all offense is necessary. Sometimes offense is necessary, but his point here is that not all offense isn't necessary all the time. Not every hill is a hill to die on, right? Not every smooth road is a road that needs a speed bump. What if my wife comes to me this afternoon and she asks me to wash the dishes? Well, there's no divine command in Scripture that says I have to wash dishes on a Sunday afternoon. So technically speaking, I'm free to do something else. Now, it's true, I understand that in an overarching way, I have all sorts of duties as a husband to my wife, and that there are also many things I'll do under threat of penalty. But in lots of very specific ways, there are things that I'm free to do and things I'm free not to do within the context of a marriage. The point being, what does love do in such instances of freedom, especially when indulging in that freedom might cause unnecessary speed bumps? In those cases, love does not insist on its own way. What would have happened if Jesus had stuck to his privilege as a son, the son of the king, the son of the temple's king, and refused to pay this tax? Well, you know, best case scenario, these tax collectors who may have come in sincerity, these tax collectors who may have come curious about Jesus and his ministry, best case scenario, they would have been jolted into a different direction by his actions. You know, they don't understand his unique rights in this case. They don't know what Peter knows. So they might have been turned off by what they perceived as pettiness, or turned off by what they perceived as a rejection of all the temple stood for, or turned off by what they perceived as his willingness to put them in a tough spot with their bosses. Worst case scenario, his refusal and the prejudice it generated against him might have jolted the whole messianic timeline into a different direction. Who knows? Word might have gotten back to Jerusalem and somehow sped up the events leading to his arrest and death, which would have disrupted centuries of prophetic timing. Of course, who knows? These are all hypothetical questions. It's all speculation, and it didn't happen. But the point is, it didn't happen because Jesus used his freedom to love. In this case, to love the tax men. He loves them by not letting them be unnecessarily tripped up by his actions. Jesus looks at this tax situation and, seeing no spiritual harm in paying the tax and seeing no spiritual benefit in refusing to pay the tax, Jesus chooses to pay it. You know, we said Jesus isn't obligated to pay this tax, and yet he agrees to do so anyway. We said he does this not out of fear. We've said he does this not for his own benefit, but with the best interest of others in mind, and that is real love. And so I've said, I think Jesus is showing his love first for his father's house. I think Jesus is showing his love second for the collectors of the temple tax. And third, I think Jesus is showing his love for Peter. How so? How does Jesus have Peter's best interest in mind here? In two main ways, I think. The first of which is by not confusing poor Peter any further. What do I mean? I mean that even the way Jesus now pays this tax sends a clear message to Peter that is consistent with what Peter has already confessed and heard about Jesus. Think about it. Peter knows that Jesus is the sinless and holy Son of God. So wouldn't it have been confusing if Jesus had now paid this tax in exactly the same way as any other man who was obligated to pay it? I mean, in light of the original nature of this tax, I feel like it might have confused Peter. Because remember, paying this tax was originally an offering of atonement. It was originally a ransom of souls. And so how could Jesus, the Son of God, need to give money to ransom himself, he who had no need of saving, he who had no sin? And so I think it's significant that although Jesus says he will pay this tax, it's not his own pockets that are emptied to do it, but the mouth of a fish that's emptied to do it. Look again at the strange story that Jesus gives to Peter, these instructions he gives to him in verse 27. However, not to give offense to them, to the tax men, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up, and when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself. You know, there are so many things we could say about this, but time is short. For instance, we could go into detail here about all the strange ways people have tried to explain away Jesus' instructions here to Peter. I mean, there's all sorts of crazy theories, like the theory that says he's really just telling Peter to catch a fish and to go sell it to pay for the tax. Yeah, well, that makes a little more sense. Sounds like something we could do. Or the theory that says he's really just telling Peter, you know, Hakuna Matata, right? Don't worry so much. You just go get on with your fishing and the tax will look after itself. That's actually another theory about this. People are really concerned about this story. I'm like, if he can make the world, why is this so hard? But I think if that's what Jesus, I think if Jesus meant these other things, he would have said it. That's not what Jesus says. Or we could go into detail here about how Peter, you know, if he'd been left to handle this situation on his own, like go catch some fish, I think his go-to option would have been a net. You know, that ups the odds tremendously. I'm just going to go throw a net in there. I'm gonna get all sorts of fish. But instead, I think it's interesting that Jesus says, get a single fishing hook. A single hook. We could then mention the interesting fact that in the oldest layers of the excavations of Peter's house, they found fish hooks. It's kind of cool. But instead, we need to focus here on this one thing: the earmarks of divine omniscience and omnipotence on clear display in the way Jesus pays his tax, right? First, as Warren Wiersbe points out, someone had to lose a coin in the water. Then a fish had to take that coin in its mouth and retain it. That same fish, he writes, then had to bite on Peter's hook with an impediment in its mouth and be caught. I would then add, to that, then you got to factor in the timing involved in all this. It has to happen right when Jesus says, go down there. I'd add, too, that Jesus knows that it's not the second fish or the fifth fish or the seventh fish. No, it's the first fish, the very first fish. He knows which fish will have the coin in his mouth. Wiersbe concludes, you cannot explain all this in a natural way. It is too complex for an accident and too difficult for human management. And really, what better way for Jesus to reinforce for Peter that he is indeed the Son of the living God, the Son of the King of the universe, and not like any other man? What better way than for him to pay the tax through such a display of sovereign power? It may be, writes B.C. Caffin, that the Lord wished to teach Peter that though he submitted to this demand like an ordinary Israelite, he was indeed the Lord of creation, that even the fishes of the sea would wait upon his will. But I said I think Jesus is showing his love for Peter here in two main ways. And if the first way was not to confuse him, I think the second way he shows his love for Peter is by paying the temple tax for him too. Maybe you didn't notice it. Maybe you didn't notice the detail in the story, but how much is the coin worth that Jesus says will be found in the mouth of that fish? Not just half a shekel, which is what the tax is, but a full shekel. Not just 2 drachma, but 4. In other words, enough money to cover Jesus and pay the ransom for Peter too. And listen to the way Jesus speaks to Peter when he tells him what to do with that money once he gets it in his hand. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself, he says. Calling back the original purpose and language of the very first temple tax, what Jesus literally says here, the words he uses here, it sounds like this. Take that money and give it to them instead of me, in the place of me. And instead of you, in the place of you. This is the language of ransom. In the New Testament, this is always the language of substitution and exchange. And in our text today, it is a foreshadowing of what Jesus will do for Peter and what Jesus will also do for you on an old rugged cross. On that cross, Jesus cries out, "It is finished." That word for finished is connected to the question that was first asked Peter in our text. Your teacher does finish the tax, doesn't he? It's a word that also means paid. Your teacher does pay the tax, doesn't he? It is paid in full, Jesus cries out on the cross. All of your obligations to God have been paid by me, by my life and by my death. My life is the ransom price freely given in exchange for your life. My body and blood are the atonement money freely given once and for all to pay for your sins. Sons enjoy freedoms, others don't. But I give up my freedoms so that you too might become sons and daughters of the King, so that you too can be made able to freely love one another. Let's pray.